This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
And the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice with specialties in unconscious bias, leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend. More at thedagobagroup.com.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
Hey there, this is Laura Kanoi.
Shh!
What? I mean, what?
Loretta Allison here. We're having a secret drive.
Oh, so that means...
Shh!
Oh, got it. If you love The Exchange, consider a small donation to the station that makes it.
Go to nhpr.org/support and chip in, and we'll send you some secret swag.
We're trying to keep things quiet, but we hope you'll make some noise for The Exchange. From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoi, and this is The Exchange. Over the last few weeks, there's been plenty of action around the issue of water contamination in the Granite State, specifically the substance known as PFOA. Earlier this month, the EPA released new guidance on how much of the chemical is too much for humans to consume, allowing state regulators to make stronger rules. Also, just last week, two lawsuits were filed against St. Gobain, the company accused of being the source of PFOA in drinking water in southern New Hampshire. Meanwhile, on Capitol Hill, Congress appears to be moving closer to updating the 40-year-old Toxic Substances and Chemicals Act, which has been widely acknowledged as inadequate to protect public health. But even with these actions, residents in the affected areas are still worried, both that the damage from PFOA in their drinking water is already done, and that there's still not enough assurance that it won't happen again. Today in The Exchange, taking action on PFOA. We'll get the latest, and let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have three guests for the hour. With us in studio is Clark Frisey. He's Assistant Commissioner for the New Hampshire Department of Environmental Services. And Clark, it's nice to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Good morning.
Also with us, Ken Ayers. He lives in Merrimack, New Hampshire. His family is on Merrimack's public water system, which has had some concerns surrounding PFOA. And Ken and his wife have become active in the search for solutions. Ken, it's good to meet you, too. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And also with us, Emily Corwin, NHPR reporter for the southern part of the state, where this has been happening. And, of course, Emily has been covering PFOA extensively. And, Emily, thank you for taking time out.
Hi, Laura.
Well, Emily, I do want to start with you. Just real basic, please, first. Just what is PFOA? What was it used for? And is it still used?
Sure. So PFOA is a chemical that's been used for since the end of the 1930s, early 1940s, in products like most famously Teflon, those Teflon stickless pans, food wrappers. It's also
pizza boxes, right?
Pizza boxes, similar chemicals. There's a few different ones, like PFOS was found on peas in the water. That's from firefighting foam. They're very... Very similar chemicals. So it's in firefighting foam as well. And just a lot of different products. This particular chemical is not being used anymore in this country because companies have voluntarily stopped using it, not because of regulation. In other countries, it is still in use. And in the United States, it's been replaced with other very similar chemicals, which we'll talk about may or may not be safe.
So if it's not being used anymore in this country, Emily, how did it get into the drinking water in southern New Hampshire?
Right. So I'm sure Clark can add some more details about the particular aspects of St. Gobain and how it may have gotten in there. But it sticks to water, and it's shown up in a lot of different sort of water, drinking water scenarios around the country. And the big picture reason, if you really step back, is that in this country, chemicals are just they're innocent until proven guilty. If we don't know anything about them, they're considered safe. basically. And so what happens is industry has, you know, they introduce all kinds of, they're constantly innovating. They introduce all kinds of chemicals. And it's not until people start getting sick, really, that we necessarily learn that they may be toxic. And so with PFOA in particular, it's not been proven that this stuff causes health problems, but it's become increasingly, information has become available showing that it does cause health problems in animals and that there may be correlations between health problems in humans. And there's been a huge settlement from the DuPont company over a decade ago regarding this and information they withheld and this chemical getting into water there.
So part of it is, as you said, Emily, just the way we regulate chemicals in this country, like you said, innocent until proven guilty. So this is out there and it's not taken off the market, so to speak, until people suspect that it's problematic.
Right. And even then, it's hard to prove it. And then it's hard to get it off the market.
And even if you take it off the market, as you've discovered, and we'll talk with our other guests as well, you can say tomorrow, I won't use this anymore, I promise, and stick to that promise. But it's out there already.
Yeah, the chemical sticks to water and it stays in the environment. And so it's still here.
Could you also jump in on that, please, Clark Frizee? How do you unravel that question of how did this happen? People are wondering why.
Yeah. So as mentioned by Emily, the chemical has been used since the early 40s. We believe 41 was the first time it was used in manufacturing in the United States. And the chemical is not really in the product. It's part of the process that creates the product. So Teflon doesn't actually have PFOA. Teflon's a different chemical. But Teflon sticks to a lot of stuff. And so what you do is you mix it with PFOA and PFOA keeps it from sticking together. And the idea was that the PFOA should fall behind in the process. So if you're coating a sheet of fabric like Saint-Gobain does with these chemicals, the PFOA should stay behind and actually was recycled because it's valuable. It costs money to create. Unfortunately, what we found is it would go up the stacks when they heated the cloth. Some would evaporate off or come out in that process. Once it got out in the environment, it would adhere to a particle in the atmosphere. And very much like Emily said, second rain hit it or any water hit it, it drops to the ground and it goes with the water down into the drinking water, the groundwater.
So it is released into the atmosphere from the smokestack during the process of creating whatever you're creating, whether it's Teflon or pizza boxes or I think Scotchgard carpets and so forth. That's PFOS, I believe. But still, whatever you're making.
PFOA, actually.
PFOA, okay.
It's very much like Emily said. It sticks to water, but almost anything else it really doesn't stick to. So it had a lot of uses. And as was mentioned, the industry has gotten away from these chemicals. They did it in a voluntary program at the request of the EPA, but not legislated. And they don't use them anymore. And we've tested the chemicals that are going into the factory, and we've tested the smokestack. We're waiting for those results to come back to prove that nothing going in has this anymore, nothing coming out has it anymore.
Anymore, but it's clearly in the soil, in the water, in some of these areas. So is that just leftovers from, you know, a decade ago?
Yeah. Unfortunately, this chemical was built to be extremely resilient. And originally, the thought was it was healthful because it was non-reactive. And if it didn't react, that would be a good thing. We're finding out that's not actually how it works. What it allows it to do is survive in the environment, survive in you for a very long time. And so even though they stopped using this 10 years ago, you still see it.
And Ken, I haven't forgotten about you. But I want to ask about your personal experience again as an active resident of Merrimack. But one more question for you, Clark, relating to what Emily said. Stepping back from a regulatory standpoint or a governmental standpoint, people in southern New Hampshire are saying, hey, how could this happen? And Emily said something that might be shocking for a lot of listeners, that chemicals are innocent until proven guilty. That's the way we regulate them.
Yes, under the TSCA, as you mentioned before, which is up for renewal right now.
That's the law in Congress, yeah.
And that was passed, which was in 76. Every chemical that was already in use was put on a list. It was grandfathered and basically was assumed safe because it was already in use. EPA has to actually go through and find some reason to question a chemical.
And there are thousands of chemicals.
Thousands upon thousands. In this case, this was labeled as an emerging contaminant because it was found that it was out in the environment. It was ubiquitous in the environment, as they say. It's everywhere. And it was found that it does bioaccumulate in humans, plants, animals, and it sticks in the body for a long time. This has a half-life. About half of it will pass out of your body in around 3.5 to 3.8 years. So it sticks in your body a really long time. So even if it's not highly toxic, the fact that it's sitting in your body for that long, it gives it a long time to do damage.
That's what bioaccumulate means then. It sticks around in your blood, in your kidneys, where?
Mostly in this case, blood. It sticks to the protein in the blood.
I want to jump in with you too, Ken, and hear your personal story. When did you and your wife first start being concerned about this?
When the news broke about the testing at the Saint-Gobain. That's when we first heard of it. You know, I always thought the Merrimack water was safe to drink. You know, and we came from Manchester. It just never thought that we would have to worry about this in New Hampshire.
So you moved from Manchester to Merrimack and you thought, oh, it's so pretty here.
Yeah,
it's so green.
You know, and then find out that the water's better in Manchester and in Nashua compared to Merrimack. So it's kind of, you know, my daughter doesn't drink soda. She drinks water at home. We've been drinking the tap water. We've been there since 09. And it's just kind of, as a parent, you know, you think you're doing good. Here, drink water, not soda. And lo and behold, you know, there's reason to be concerned about the water. So,
and she's 12, so her body's
correct.
Developing. It's even more concerning, as we know, with any chemical. It's more concerning with children because their bodies are growing and developing.
Yes. And, you know, it's just hopefully there we can fix what's going on. There's technology out there to correct the problem, and hopefully it gets fixed.
Well, and we'll definitely talk about solutions, fixes, who pays for it, because that's an issue, and who does it. But what went through your mind, Ken, when you and your wife first started reading about this chemical that was in your water supply and you've been drinking it all these years?
How much damage did we do to ourselves? You know, I went to the town hall meeting. There was a lot of people there, a lot of concerns, and hearing some people that questioning whether or not their issues with cancer or other, you know, family member, was it related to drinking the water? There was one woman who it really hit you. Her husband passed, and she was questioning, did I do this? Because I gave him tap water.
Wow.
So, and there was, well, you know, there was quite a few, I don't know, a couple hundred people at the meeting, but there was like four or five people that got up and expressed concerns from like thyroid cancer to prostate cancer. So it's scary in that respect that, you know, here you are, you know, we're in the United States of America, and, you know, you always joke about, you know, if you go visit tourist place about drinking the water, but now you got to worry about it in your own hometown. So,
who were residents at that meeting, Ken, frustrated against the most? Was it the company? Was it the town? Was it the state? Was it the feds? I mean, where was that frustration aimed at the most?
I have to say it was kind of even everywhere. You know, when it comes to the fact that here's a company, you know, at least they, you know, say, hey, we tested 30, then find out there was earlier testing, but it wasn't made known to people.
Mm-hmm. Testing the wells, you mean.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of people with well water that's very close to the facility that were very concerned. It went all around. I mean, I know there was a woman asking, yeah, is it safe to take a shower? And, you know, technically, you know, you're taking a shower and your pores open up. So it's, you know what I mean? So it's scary. You know?
Right. It's hard to take a shower with bottled water.
Yeah. So, and then there were people who were, you know, worried about, you know, questioning what happened with the state. Where was the regulation? Where was the, you know, why was the stuff allowed to be released in the air? And they like the people in Litchfield, you know, the reason, you know, it's getting released in the air and, you know, the wind's taking it to the east and, you know, a lot of people in that area were on well water. And so That's why you have such a – it's so expanded. It's not just in Merrimack. It's Litchfield. Find out, you know, parts of Manchester, Bedford, you know. And then this kind of – this is this opening a can of worms in a sense, because now you're starting to find out that it's other places, you know.
Every week there's a new sort of – the concentric circles seem to grow wider.
Yes.
Speaking of can of worms, one thing we're really going to try and untangle this hour is what you mentioned, Ken, the regulations, who's in charge, who isn't, what Congress is doing. But let me also invite our listeners to join us. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Today in the exchange, once again, we're looking at PFOA. Some of the actions around this water contaminant recently, from a lawsuit against the plastics plant that many suspect is its source, to debate in Congress over a Toxic Substances Act that many people say need to be updated, to new guidance from EPA on how much of this chemical is too much. Let's take your questions and comments at 1-800-892-6477. And all of you, Sarah's calling first from Dover. Hi, Sarah, you're in the exchange. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
This may not quite relate to PFOA, but I've always wondered over the years, why are companies allowed to put water out that's dirtier than what they took in? In other words, they might be using town or well water. I know of the paper companies up in Maine used to have to clean the water out of the Androscoggin so they could use it to produce paper, but then they would just dump everything back into the river. They wouldn't clean it. So it was going out dirtier than what it came in. That's all I have to say.
Well, and Sarah, I appreciate the call. It's kind of a fundamental question. And Clark, it's a toughie, but I'll throw it to you.
Yeah, we do have regulations in the state as to what can be put out of a factory. Now, in this case, it was air, but similarly with water. Anything that you put out, it has to be put to certain levels. In the case of water going out into the groundwater, the state treats all groundwater in trust for the state. And the way we protect that is we hold it to drinking water levels. So if you put water out, it needs to be at drinking water levels. Now, if you took in perfectly pristine water and you put a little bit of a chemical in, it may be within the drinking water standards. So the question of do you have to purify it to better than you took it in? Not necessarily.
So, but the problem with this particular instance then is that the water contamination happened because of air. Stuff right. was put in the air, so it didn't go through the regular channels.
Yeah, and in this case, they actually had an air permit to use this chemical and put out a very, very limited amount. And when they moved the facility in, they measured at the stacks of the place they moved the work from. And with the technology of the time, they measured that there was nothing coming out of the stacks. Unfortunately, what we found out is as the technology got better, they could measure to lower and lower levels, and they found out they were actually emitting some out of the stacks. When they notified us of that, we immediately worked with them, got them on a consent order, and got them to take this out of their process, which they did. And they very aggressively drove it down, and this last year they used none whatsoever.
Well, and Sarah, it's a great question, and maybe a little bit later we can talk more about federal regulations and how they determine what you guys at DES can do. But Emily, I can see you want to jump in too.
Oh, I just wanted to say that and you sort of got to it a bit, but you know, if you're measuring for drinking water standards, I think part of the bigger picture problem is just that, you know, PFOA was something that the state and even federal regulators were just not paying any attention to because there hadn't been any, you know, awareness of it. And so even if you're measuring for certain things that you know need to be safe, if you're not measuring for this chemical, you're just not going to know about it getting into water. And I'm sure that goes for other chemicals that are just not on our radar at all.
Yeah, and that's something that I've been struck paying attention to this, Emily, is that there are so many chemicals. Some may be safe, some we don't know. Do you want to jump in too, Ken?
Yeah, I'm just curious. Do you know where they moved the chemical from, whatever facility that they brought it to Merrimack?
Yeah, the company used to be called ChemFab, and they had facilities in Hoosick Falls, New York, and
right,
North
that's
Bennington,
been a famous
Vermont,
case, yeah.
In our area. In fact, that's how we really came to find this out, is Hoosick Falls started investigating first. It was found in the groundwater there. From there, Vermont tested. We started getting ready to test ourselves, and Saint-Gobain, to their credit, jumped ahead and said, oh, these other facilities have this. I want to go test our water. They tested their own water and found that it was contaminated. And when they did, that's when we really swung into action, did all the testing in Litchfield and the other places that Kenneth's mentioned.
Well, and Sarah, thank you for the call. It's a good question. And in a moment, we'll take a lot more of your calls, questions, comments, concerns. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. More in a moment. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, what to do about PFOA, with new guidance from the Environmental Protection Agency on how much of this chemical is too much, and a lawsuit against the plastics plant in southern New Hampshire that may be its source. There's been a lot of action around this issue of water contamination in the Granite State, but many people are still worried that the damage might already be done and that there's not enough assurance at this point that it won't happen again. Let's hear from you, your questions and comments at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have three guests for the hour. Clark Frisey is here, Assistant Commissioner for the New Hampshire Department of Environmental Services. Ken Ayers is here. He lives in Merrimack, New Hampshire, one of the communities that has been affected by this. And Ken and his wife have been active in the search for solutions here. Also with us, Emily Corwin, NHPR's reporter for the southern part of the state. She's been covering this PFOA story. And all of you, again, we're going to our listeners. Lots of questions and comments. And Tasha's next from Merrimack. Hi, Tasha. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
So grateful you're covering this. I've been a resident here since 2006. Came down with thyroid disease a couple of years ago. With no family background with it. My daughter also goes to school here and has been drinking the water since she was 8 months old. She is now in fifth grade. ADHD is part of a diagnosis that she has, which can I have an appointment with her pediatrician to get her thyroid tested because oftentimes ADHD is a thyroid dysfunction. And my concern is that the PFOA may have affected this aspect in her and be the reason why she has the ADHD. My concern is the town water. A lot of the attention is being given to people with private wells living in the vicinity of St. Gobain's facility, but I don't see any attention being given to those of us on town water that have been consuming this chemical for all these years, and the schools have no filtration, not in their bubblers, the water that they drink from in the fountains or in the preparation of the food. And I want to know how and when these will be addressed because the expense of filtering, I rent, and my expense per month already since this has all hit the fan is starting to get above what I can afford. And I can't get my landlord to do a point of entry filtration.
And yes. Tasha, you've got enough problems with your health problems and your daughter's issues.
Yes,
so I'm so
my
sorry.
My concern is for those of us that already have thyroid disease, PFOA is apparently a trigger for thyroid disease. It's one of the six illnesses it's
right,
associated
I've seen
with.
That. Mm-hmm.
We're already compromised. So I think the town water, even though it's below 70 parts per trillion, it still has a presence up to, in one of the wells, I think it was 52 or 57 in the latest, somewhere around there in the latest testing.
Okay. Well, Tasha, a couple important points that you raised. So let's deal with them. And first of all, she said that she's on public water in Merrimack. Ken, that's the case with you as well, right?
Yes, it is. Actually, one of the wells, they say it's offline at the time. It was over 90.
Parts per trillion.
Parts per trillion.
And
the other
the EPA's, excuse me for interrupting, I just want to make it clear for the audience, the EPA's new guideline says 70 parts per trillion
70.
Is acceptable. Go ahead,
right.
Sorry.
So then there's another well that's within, I believe was like 250 feet from wells 4 and 5. And one was at 90, the other one was around the 56 range. The other interesting thing that go along with the schools, they tested the elementary schools, and they're all on public water. They all came back with different results.
Every school?
each school. The Reed's Ferry, which is the one that my daughter went to, I believe, I forget the exact number, but it was in the 40 range. The other ones were in the mid-20 range. So the question is it, you know, here it is, you know, they're public water. Clarify, we're public water, but it's well water.
I see. It's not a reservoir like in Concord or
right.
Manchester.
There are six wells within the Merrimack Water District. So when you're drinking, you're drinking well water, you know, and here it is, you know, you tested the three elementary schools. Granted, I don't know if they test them the same day, but three different areas, one within the town of Merrimack, three different numbers. So you don't know one day from the next really what's your reading going to be. It all depends on where you are in town. You know, if you're close to the Reed's Ferry, you're close to St. Cobain, it's probably going to be higher than down almost by the Nashua border.
Wow. So it's interesting, Emily, a lot of the focus in this story has been on private wells. But Ken and Tasha, our caller, are telling us Merrimack, at least anyway, is on a public well system. So can you just help us figure that out, Emily, please?
Right. So, I mean, Ken provided a lot of this information, but, you know, part of this, the issue is that the EPA has decided or, you know, come up with 70 parts per trillion. That's a concentration of this chemical in water that they've deemed an acceptable amount to drink in the long term.
Over your lifetime.
Right. And yet there is, you know, emerging science. Some scientists will say that anything over background, which is, you know, in the 5-6 parts per trillion range, it's not that we know it's not safe. It's that it's not a very precautionary way to go about it. It's the idea being, if you don't know for certain something's safe, many would say we should be as strict as possible. We should be as, you know, take as many precautions as possible. And so a lot of people, you know, feel confused by all of the, you know, information. Some scientists are saying 70 is far too high. The EPA is saying 70 is like this, you know, new advisory level. We've done a lot of they put a lot of research into that, and people who are stuck in between, like 50, 30, you know, 40, 50 parts per trillion, is like, well, who do I believe? Is this safe? And if this stuff builds up in my body, what's the difference between 70 and 40? It's coming in and it's not going out. So
right, bioaccumulates, as yeah. Clark said earlier. Ken, you were nodding. Do you want to jump in there?
Well, you know, in the same time frame, Vermont, they have their number at 20. So what does Vermont – I'm curious, what is Vermont saying? Okay, why are they saying 20? And why are the EPA saying 70? I mean, 20 from 70 is a big difference.
And then New Hampshire, I think, was at 100, right, Clark?
Right. We had used what's been published in some peer-reviewed activities, and primarily the EPA had used this in Region 2, which is the Hoosick Falls area. And the Maine's equivalent department of DES put out a very well-published or very well-reviewed published document as to how they did their setting. They have a Loring Air Force Base up there and had a lot of contamination. They used 100 parts per trillion. We have an environmental health division, and they read through all the studies they could get and came up with 100 while we were waiting for the latest peer-reviewed fit to be completed for the EPA, which is where the 70 comes from.
And again, this EPA advisory is pretty new, right? Just in the last week or two.
Yeah, so we've only had it for about a week.
So can you help us figure this out, Clark? What a part per trillion is? I mean, is 70 parts per trillion, you know, is that a drop in a bucket, a drop in a pool, a drop in a pond? I mean, yeah. I have no idea really what that is.
It is really hard to sort of get that in your mind. And it's one of the few contaminants that we deal with at these sort of very, very low concentrations. One of the comments we were able to find online to get that sort of feeling is a part per billion is one drop in an Olympic-sized swimming pool. So a part per trillion would be one drop of water in 1,000 Olympic swimming pools. So
wow, that's not very much.
It's very, very low concentrations. And so as Ken said, you're stuck with that problem. You want to be safe with your children. You want to be very, very protective. How low is low enough? And part of the studies have been, if you're drinking this in, how fast does your body get it out? And the goal is to get to a low enough level that it doesn't bioaccumulate, that it doesn't concentrate in your blood, and that your body is able to flush this out well enough that it protects you. And so the 70 is from the latest science. It was very heavily peer-reviewed for years. And that was part of the frustration is and you run into this. The EPA starts a study to look at a chemical. They send it out for peer review. They do a very thorough job, but it takes time. And meanwhile, you're sitting there drinking water and you're wanting to know.
Well, people like Ken or Tasha, right. Our caller. Tasha, the poor thing, has thyroid problems. Her daughter has ADHD, and she's wondering, is this the water? And you understand that EPA wants to be scientifically rigorous. On the other hand, people are feeling, you know, desperate and scared.
Right. And as a state, we're sort of stuck in the middle. We're looking at the best science that's already been published and peer-reviewed. We're trying to use that. And similarly, Vermont, they have a very thorough process. This is how they do it. And their process came up with 20. Our process came up with 100 while we're all waiting for EPA. And they came out at 70, which was neither of the two numbers. And it is a big issue when you're on public water or private. You're still drinking these chemicals. And in the case of the public water, very much as Ken said, in Merrimack, it's off of wells. And they have a number of wells, and they're all tested at different levels. And depending on which well they're using on which day, you get a mix, a blend in the pipes. And so that blend, if you're near a well that's at a higher contamination, your drinking water will have a higher contamination. And so we've been working with MVD, which is the Merrimack Village District that does water in Merrimack and also sells water to Penichuk that's served in Bedford. We've been working with them on options on how can they drive that level down as low as possible because a couple of their wells have tested higher. One is in the 50 to 60 range. It's been tested multiple times. And one well has tested over 90. Now, the one that's tested that high, they've not used since last year. But we're coming up on summer. It gets hot. People draw more water. At some point, if they have to bring those wells on, there's a concern. So we have been talking to them about the opportunity to use the interconnect they have with Penichuk, who is off of surface waters, and use that to actually flood their system with some water and dilute the contamination.
So is surface water, and just to clarify for folks, roughly 60% of New Hampshire is on public water supplies, roughly 40%, right, is on?
I think it's a little closer to 50-50, but yes, it's
okay.
A large portion of the state is on private wells.
And the portion that's on public water supplies, are most of those surface waters, like, again, you know, the reservoirs in Concord and Manchester and so
forth? It's a mix. Even Penichuk, they've got a mix of sources. They draw from the Merrimack River, which is the surface water. Mm-hmm. They have a surface reservoir, and they have a number of wells throughout the state. So it's really a mix.
And this may sound like a really basic question, but I'm going to ask you anyway. Is surface water, quote unquote, better than well water?
What we found so far, and particularly with the Merrimack, is that anything that's flowing tends to be very low levels.
Even if it's a
at
lake.
At the background levels, like Emily said. At the lakes, if they're fully embayed where they don't move, Vermont had one case where a lake at a college that was very near their plant that had no flow in and out tested with slightly elevated levels. It wasn't as high as, say, the 90 at the one well, but they're relatively lower levels.
Did you want to jump in, Emily or Ken? Go ahead, Ken.
My question, like Nashua, the Penichuk water system, do they have a better filtration system than compared to Merrimack? I mean, or in Manchester, do they have better systems in place compared to Merrimack?
Well, that's a good question, too. And Tasha, our caller, asked that. So, yeah, thank you, Ken, for bringing that up. It's not just a question of what's there. It's a question of how good are the filtration systems at getting this out. Can you jump on that, Clark?
Well, to answer Ken's question directly, Penichuk does do some filtration, but really it's that their sources are lower. Merrimack has some wells that are low. Penichuk has a wider variety of sources that are all low. And so they're starting with cleaner water. They do some filtration. Carbon, activated carbon, is a common filtration technology where you run the water through it and it filters out impurities. It is very effective. And so point of entry treatment, like Tasha talked about, can be put on a house and clean all of the water coming into the house. The other technology that works is reverse osmosis, where you pressurize water through a membrane, clean water goes through, the contaminants are kept out. That has other complications to it, but that also does work.
Well, and that gets the cost of question of who pays for it, Emily, and that's been an issue, right? I mean, who's going to pay for filtration systems? The company's been paying for bottled water, but that's yet to be determined.
Right. And I'm sure that Clark can talk more about remediation issues. And I know it's still ongoing. One thing that comes up here, though, is the new class action lawsuit that's been filed against class members in, you know, the surrounding Saint-Gobain and against the company Saint-Gobain. And to become a class member, you know, the one individual has filed, and then anyone who is within a 2-mile radius on well water qualifies to be a class member in this lawsuit. And
that just came out last week.
Last week. And I don't know what kind of wrenches this throws into the remediation discussion that you guys are having. But basically what they're asking for is for the company to directly pay out, you know, based partly on profits that they've made at the expense of these abutting communities, to pay out 2 individuals living in the area. In part of that is a matter of, you know, remediation. Part of it is also just a matter of like quality of life, housing values that may decrease, basically all of the monetary and experiential effects. This class lawsuit is saying, you know, Saint-Gobain should be held responsible. Of course, they are not proven definitively to be the source of this stuff, but it seems to be relatively clear.
And I do want to let our listeners know we did try to get a representative from Saint-Gobain to join us today since we're talking about them so much. They were unable to provide a representative. I have an email there from them, though, telling us what they wanted us to say on the air because they weren't able to provide somebody. It says, Saint-Gobain Performance Plastics has been and continues to be focused on providing clean drinking water to the residents of Merrimack, Litchfield, and other towns within the 1.5-mile radius of our plant. To that end, this email says, we are funding the engineering design work by Penajuk Corporation to explore options. So these are some of the options that we've been talking about. And this email from Saint-Gobain says, we will continue to work closely with local and state officials as well. So I just want to let people know that that's the statement from Saint-Gobain and that we did try to get them on the air with us today. Go ahead, Emily.
And I just wanted to, you know, ask Clark, I'm curious to know what you tell people who are like Ken on Merrimack Valley Water who are not happy with that. A lot of people aren't. I'm hearing from them. What do you tell them about what to do and how to think about their contamination levels?
The first thing I suggest is if they're unhappy, they go to their service provider, Mount Merrimack Village, and let them know that they're unhappy. As the regulating authority in the state, we are trying to take – now we have a health advisory in the latest science. We're trying to go and get emergency rulemaking done to get a rule in place. Right now, this is not a regulated contaminant until we get a rule placed. Once we do an emergency rule, we have 180 days to go through the full process with public comment and everything and come up with an official final rule. As far as where we're at right now, the levels that they have when they manage their wells and they get them down, we are finding that they are lower, down around 20 parts per trillion. And obviously, we'd like them to be as low as possible. It does get to be a question of what is the cost and what is the technical limitations. We are concerned that as it gets hotter, they do have those wells that are slightly more contaminated, and we would like those not to come online. And we've talked to them and talked to them about options. We've made it very clear that the state will work with them because you'd have to get a rate set up between Penajuk and MVD for them to share water.
MVD is Merrimack.
Merrimack Village.
Village District. Yep. Okay.
I always say Merrimack Valley too.
That's okay.
I always do the same thing. People make fun of me for it. But we've been working with them to let them know we can help them get through any regulatory hurdles so that they could share this water and drive down the contamination level. And I did meet with their board, and they are looking at it, but they've not done it as of yet.
Here's an email that came in from Mike in Ware. He says, I'm a home inspector that does inspections in Merrimack. Can you please discuss the concern that many buyers and sellers of homes in Merrimack have expressed regarding the effect on home values in Merrimack as a result of the PFOA contamination? Mike, thank you for the email. And Ken, I'll just turn to you real quickly. Is that another concern that has come up in your community?
I'm not 100% sure. I know, you know, I have seen some postings that people are concerned. I mean, you know, if you're trying to sell your home and this is in the news, people are going to be wondering, you know. Put it this way, if I was looking for a home right now, I wouldn't be looking in Merrimack.
Okay, Mike, thank you for the email. And we will take a lot more of your emails and phone calls after a short break. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking once again at PFOA, the water contaminant that has caused a lot of worry, especially in southern New Hampshire. There's been a lot going on around this story, which has been emerging all spring. There's new guidance from EPA about how much of this chemical is too much. There's a lawsuit against the plastics plant that is blamed for the contamination. And there is some new legislation on Capitol Hill. Well, an update, actually, of some old legislation that many people feel is needed. With us now for more on that is David Andrews. He's senior scientist with the Environmental Working Group. That's an organization that has researched and advocated around toxic chemicals for a long time. David Andrews, welcome to The Exchange. Good to have you.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here today.
Well, before we get to what's happening on Capitol Hill, just back up, please, David, if you could. Here in New Hampshire, people have really just started learning about PFOA. How long has your group been looking at this chemical?
That's a great question. So we actually started working on the issue over 10 years ago. And what we originally, our original involvement with this case or with this pollution issue came out of a court case in around pollution in Parkersburg, West Virginia, the Mid-Ohio Valley. And this is where DuPont had a factory and actually ended up contaminating the entire surrounding area. And so in internal court documents that ended up becoming public and they were all submitted to EPA, there's a treasure trove of information documenting what DuPont knew going back decades about the health concerns of these chemicals. They'd actually been testing the community water, not necessarily telling the community. And so we helped publicize all of these internal documents, really drew attention to the issue, and also petitioned EPA to fine DuPont for failing to submit this information to the agency. One of the few requirements under our current chemical legislation is that if you do a test and find that a chemical may pose serious harm or risk to the community, you have to provide that information to EPA. And DuPont failed to do that on a number of cases and for a number of studies they did and of some monitoring of their pregnant workers even.
So you've been looking at this issue for a while at the Environmental Working Group. And as you alluded to, David, there's a new effort in Congress to update the regulation of chemicals, this bill from the 1970s. So it's been a while. I know your organization is disappointed in this effort, but before we get to that, what is the good part about this effort to update the toxic chemicals and substances regulations?
Sure. You know, and a lot of this is untested at this point. We do expect the legislation. It's passed through conference committee, is voted on by the House, and we expect within the next week or two it'll end up on the president's desk and most likely become law. Time will tell how effective this new legislation is, and then that's our major message on this. There are some places where EPA will have expanded authority to require testing of chemicals. They do have to make a determination before a chemical enters the market whether or not it's safe.
That's a big change, isn't it? From chemicals, you know, don't have to be, they're innocent until proven guilty right now, right?
That's correct. And
that's a big change.
General framework still stays where chemicals are innocent until proven guilty. But there is a slightly higher burden of proof before a chemical enters the market, which is an important change. And then there's increased level of substantiation for making confidentiality claims, hiding information from the public. So there are a number of important changes. We do have concerns that it won't be good enough for public health.
Yeah, your organization has called this inadequate. Go ahead, David. Yeah.
Yeah, this is a bill that really originated with the chemical industry in the design. We think there's significant changes that could have been made. Not to say that the legislators that have been involved haven't been fighting to make this as strong as possible. But there are a number of places where we think this falls short of what's needed for public health. And the contamination from PFOA and the decades it took for EPA to take action, negotiate a voluntary phase out, really highlight the deficiencies in our current legislation. And this new legislation does require EPA to take faster action on a few priority chemicals, but it doesn't necessarily adequately fund the agency to do the studies it needs. EPA has said there's 1,000 chemicals that we really should review for their safety and potential impacts on public health. And yet, current pace, you know, we may be reviewing a few chemicals a year.
Wow. Well, and we have the situation in New Hampshire, as I know you're aware, David, and a lot of people are worried about their water and PFOA. Lots of people upset, lots of finger pointing. People are blaming the company. People are blaming the state government. People are wondering why their towns weren't more on this. People are blaming EPA, Congress. Who do you blame?
Well, you know, I think the blame lies originally with the company that manufactured this and released it to the environment. And you know, some of this is, you know, I think it's a responsible stewardship of the chemicals and the technology you're using. This, at the very least, DuPont knew about how persistent this chemical was, how once it goes out into the environment, it essentially irreversibly pollutes. It doesn't break down under normal environmental conditions. And then there's lots of early initial warning signs of toxicity concerns. What's extremely concerning is that over time, the more we study this chemical, the lower and lower the supposed safe concentration is. So in the end of the day, this is a chemical you don't want in your water at all. You don't want it in your environment.
Well, last question for you, David, if I could, please. Again, looking at this update of the bill that you mentioned, we heard just recently that Senator Rand Paul has put a hold on this bill, this update that has passed the House already, as you said. What's Senator Paul's concern?
He voiced concern that he wanted to read through the bill in detail for his constituents and make sure, you know, it is, I believe it's about 180-page PDF file, just go through all the legislation, and that it does have some criminal statutes in terms of pollution and releasing information, and just really just giving it a pause and go through in a little more detail. We don't expect, at least the people I've talked to in the D.C. area don't expect this to be a significant setback or change to the bill. We expect it to move forward. But, you know, it is politics in D.C. There's always a bit of uncertainty.
Okay. David, thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That's David Andrews, senior scientist with the Environmental Working Group, which, as we heard, is an organization that researches and advocates around toxic chemicals. Environmental Working Group has been looking at PFOA for a long time, as David told us. Again, the exchange number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Emily, Ken, and Clark, let's go right back to our listeners. And George is in Belmont. Hi, George. You're on the exchange. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Well, we don't have the exact same problem you people are discussing. However, we do have an aquifer underneath the town, and it covers around 33% of the town. And the town, before they knew there was an aquifer there, they zoned the area that is most vulnerable industrial. And I'm an engineer, and I went to the town. I says, you know, these are the you have to protect your water supply because three towns are getting water from this aquifer. You got Northfield, Tilton, and Belmont.
So zoned industrial so that folks won't drink it?
Zoned industrial development.
I see.
So, I mean, and it can't be zoned industrial development because, you know, there's a possibility that they can pollute the aquifer and then three towns will be out of the water.
I see what you're saying, George. Yeah, I apologize. I didn't get it at first.
I mean,
yeah,
it's a long story, but
sure.
I'd like to cut it short. The town fathers and the planning board have no background to make a judgment based on the hydrology of the aquifer. It's a shallow drift aquifer, and what they allowed is a transfer station to be placed on top of it.
Ah, I see.
They're going to be hauling in 150,000 tons of garbage.
And who knows what leaks into the aquifer. Wow. George, thank you so much for calling. Emily, do you want to jump in on this?
Yeah, I just wanted to connect the dots here. What George is talking about, I know that there's been some PFOA contamination in Amherst, and that Amherst, and you will know this better than I, is situated over a very valuable aquifer. And I think it, you know, the specifics about that I'll leave for Clark perhaps, but I just think it really puts the emphasis of the conversation into the question of, you know, water as a resource. And this is a problem not just with PFOA, with, you know, lead and Flint. And, like, there's contamination of water across the country. And this is something that we have thought of as, you know, it's so essential to our health, and it's something that we think of as being pristine, and we think of our aquifers as being pristine. And I think that question of, like, zoning above ground based on what's below ground, I don't know how often that thought process is taken into consideration in zoning. So
yeah, that's really interesting. And George, thank you for the call. It's a really good point. Do towns, Clark, right now, if they want to build an industrial facility or a factory or a dump, as George describes, do they have to zone above ground for what's below ground, as Emily put it?
I don't believe they're required to. I think we are seeing more and more towns that are paying attention to what's going on. And it was mentioned Amherst. We do have other sites in the state that have PFCs, which is this old class of chemicals, PFOS, PFOA. We have Pease site at Pease Air Force Base, the St. Cobain site, Merrimack. We did test around the old Merrimack landfill and found that there were elevated levels there because these chemicals were in so many products, so many things that people bought, used, and then threw away. And if the landfill wasn't lined, leaks down into the water. In the case of Amherst, they do pay very close attention to their aquifer. However, there was a factory there 30 years ago. And 30 years ago, they were running the same sort of processes as St. Gobain, and they have caused some contamination in the area. And we are looking at other landfills that are unlined that might have these chemicals in them also.
Well, George, thanks a lot for the call. And again, you can join us at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Let's go next to Meredith in Concord. Hi, Meredith. You're on the exchange. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you, Laura. I actually had two comments. The first is that I think this is a really good opportunity for people to look around our own homes and to try to reduce the toxic things that we have a choice over. You know, the stuff that we don't have a choice about is very scary, but I think if people look under their kitchen sink, for example, and look at the cleaning products that they're using, you know, you can really make a huge difference reducing toxic use in your own home. And then my other comment is I hope that people think about these issues in the upcoming elections and really think carefully about whether their candidate supports regulation of these kinds of toxic chemicals, and also whether they support funding for the very important work that our state and federal agencies need to do in order to protect us from these kinds of things.
Well, Meredith, thank you for the call. Yeah, and I have an email to that effect, too. Nancy in Vermont says, for all who are planning on voting in November, Nancy says, Trump and most Republicans are trying to completely deregulate our industrial processes. Many want to abolish the EPA. Just real quickly, Emily, do you see this water contamination story becoming a political story for the fall elections? I know you're not our political reporter, but
I know. I mean, I'll just speak as a reporter, as someone who's trying to convey this information to the public at large. It's a lot easier to interest people who are drinking contaminated water in PFOA than it is to interest people who are not or who don't know that they are. It's not like a real sexy issue. But when people say, what can we do about this? How did this happen? It really seems to me that it comes down to those elected officials, it's a lot easier to make change through your elected officials than it is to somehow convince companies to behave ethically otherwise.
Again, our phone number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Mike's in Bedford. Hi, Mike. You're on the exchange. Thanks for calling in.
Oh, hi, Laura. Thanks a lot. I'm in Bedford. I'm going to switch to bottled water, but which bottled water in the stores is tested from PFOA? Does NHPS test the actual commercial bottled waters for PFOA so you know which one's the Bye-bye.
You know, Mike, this is a great question. And many years ago, when I was still out reporting, I remember finding out that bottled water isn't as pure as the snow either. Have you looked at this, Ken, or are you just taking the bottled water that the company's been giving you?
Well, I haven't been getting bottled water from them.
Oh, you haven't been?
No.
Okay.
He's on the public water, just like we talked about, so he doesn't qualify because it's right. Under the 70 parts per trillion.
Oh. So you've been buying your own bottled water.
Yeah. It's a good question. It's kind of just going on faith, hopefully, that it's cleaner than the town water.
Ken's looking at me like, really? You're giving me one more thing to worry about. But that's an important point that Emily brought up. So, Ken, because you are not in the right area, so to speak, and some water sources in your town have tested below this this level of 70, you're not getting free bottled water from the company.
Actually, it's kind of funny. What we do is we have bought some bottled water, and my father-in-law lives in Manchester, and he takes the empty bottles and he fills them up at his house for us.
Because
I know in Manchester, it's safe to drink. So that's what we've been doing.
And showering, quick showers.
Yeah, that's unfortunate. Yeah, they just basically, take the showers and kind of deal with it. And, for us, we're kind of doing a wait and see, and in the sense of we're hoping something gets done before we have to put out our own money for a home phone filtration system.
Right.
And the big question is, which one?
And who's going to pay for it? And who's going to pay for it? Go ahead, Clark.
Well, to answer Mike's question, we in the state have a contract for bottled water. It's with Monadnock, and we have tested it, and it does test at background levels, 2-3 parts per trillion. So it is good, safe water. That's the one we have tested because that's what we're delivering.
Okay. Mike, thank you very much for the question. And all of you, I had a ton more questions, but we've run out of time. So I want to thank you all very much for being here. Clark Frisey, thank you. It was good to meet you.
Nice to meet you, too.
Clark Frisey, Assistant Commissioner for the New Hampshire Department of Environmental Services. Ken, good luck to you and your family. It was good to meet you, too.
Thank you.
Ken Ayers, again, he lives in Merrimack, New Hampshire. And Emily Corwin, thank you for helping us out with the show.
Sure thing.
Emily Corwin, NHPR's reporter for the southern part of the state. Remember, the conversation always continues online on Facebook and at nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. The senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Faith Meixel and Jessica Hunt. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Knoy.